Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Libby Casey of APRN. Steve, big news with regard to Sarah Palin's defense fund. Tell us about it.
An independent investigator appointed by the state released findings late in the week that the fund, a legal defense fund, established to help Sarah Palin pay some of her, obviously her attorney fees and things, was found to violate state ethics laws. And as part of the way to reconcile this infraction is that the former governor, she's going to have to return the $380,000 that is in that fund. Now, there's no ethics charge against her, no allegation against her. She didn't spend any of that money, but she does have to return it to the donors who gave the money to help pay for attorney fees and things like the Troopergate case that happened a couple of years ago and some of the other ethics charges that came down against her while she was governor.
Jill, there's an interesting question here. Is we're ever going to find out who gave this money?
Well, the investigator found that one of the things they can do to correct the violation with the trust itself is the disclosure of the donors, which is something that the trust had said it would do on its website when people go there to make the donation. It's a little bit unclear to me because that's in a section that just deals with the corrective action order from the investigator and the settlement agreement. But then you have this other list that's a separate section, which are the agreed to items that the governor will take care of. That one's not enumerated specifically in those list of items that everybody signed off on, but it's probably covered generically in a request and an agreement that the governor will adhere to the items and the intent of the corrective action order. But I'm not, that doesn't give me, the fact that it's not broken out as its own line item doesn't give me comfort that we'll
learn
those
names.
And
one way or the other, it could take quite a bit of time.
It could, yeah. Yeah.
And there were a lot of donors, too. I think you were capped at $150, mm-hmm. so they got up to $380,000, so that's an awful lot of donations.
And there's some nuance in there, too. There's an additional $30-some-odd thousand that came in after the time she resigned as governor. Right. That money doesn't need to be returned because she wasn't in any kind of official capacity. And, of course, since then, we have a new fund, which has risen up in place of the old fund, and they've already put out solicitations for donations.
Do one of those Truth Squad graphics here so that people can understand all the lines and points and so forth. Libby, the United States Supreme Court, in a major case involving other people, also ruled on the case of the indictment of Bruce Wyrock, Juneau legislator, and it could have quite an impact here in Alaska on his trial and the corruption trials more generically. Tell us about it.
That's right. Well, it all circles around what's called the Honest Services Law that says elected officials and the heads of big companies should basically serve the public honestly. But the Supreme Court says that it's been used far too broadly in prosecutions and, in fact, should only apply to bribes and kickback scenarios. Now, Wyrock was accused of breaking that law for not disclosing that he'd asked VECO for a job. At the time, he was a state legislator and voting on legislation affecting VECO. The feds want to charge him with mail fraud for using the mail to say, hey, I'd work for you guys in the future. And they say he broke the Honest Services Law for not disclosing that he'd asked for that job. But yesterday the Supreme Court said since it's limiting the law, it really is a big blow to the government's case against Bruce Wyrock. I went to the Supreme Court yesterday morning in anticipation that these decisions might come down because the court's getting very close to the end of its term. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg read the opinions in all three cases. The Skilling decision came down first. That's Jeffrey Skilling, who used to run Enron, who among his many convictions was accused of not providing honest services when he allegedly covered up the company's financial problems. And then the decision in another related case involving Conrad Black, a media mogul who skimmed money off the top of bogus legal agreements and fees, that came down. And then finally, it was Bruce Wyrock. But he was sort of small potatoes compared to the other two. The Skilling decision was 40 pages long, a tight booklet. And the Wyrock decision, about one sentence. It just said the lower court decision was vacated, and it was being sent back in light of the Skilling decision. So a lot of the national media is focused on those two high-profile cases. They haven't really mentioned Bruce Wyrock a whole lot, but it is a significant thing because we're going to sort of see this play out in a big way, and his case will get bounced down probably all the way back down to Alaska, and we'll see if the government has really any case against him anymore.
I think the most likely thing we'll see is that it'll be back in Judge Sedgwick's court here in Anchorage. It's also important to note that both Conrad Black and Skilling are in prison at the present time. They're serving sentences, which include this and other charges. Steve, the homeless issue is back on the front page. The mayor responds, the commuter responds at the death of a homeless person.
Yeah, this is number 22. I believe we have had 22 deaths of homeless people in the last 12 months or so. This is something that's been unprecedented, I think, in Anchorage history. I can remember when we would lose one or two in the 80s during some severe cold snaps, and it was huge headlines of where are we going to folks, where can folks go to get shelter? This is something that I don't believe we've really ever seen. A woman was found dead in a camp in Anchorage, and this, every time this happens, it rekindles the debate over what should be done to help Anchorage's homeless. These folks are living in very poor conditions. They're outside exposed to the elements. And it must be said, too, that some of the people who are homeless want to be homeless. They want to live on the streets. This is a chosen lifestyle. This isn't something that they've been forced to do.
It should be noted that some of the homeless die in hospitals. They die in,
yes,
with their relatives. They die in the hotel rooms they've checked in.
That's right.
What really stands out here is the people dying in the woods in the tent or just a right. lean-to or something like that.
It's a difficult lifestyle, yes. And it's something that the city's struggling with. There have been proposals ranging from a tent city in some location that would be approved by the city to low-income apartments that would be made available for folks. So this is something that the city continues to struggle with.
Joe Miller continues to gain attention nationally and locally for his challenge to Lisa Murkowski. Quite a lot of attention this week. Tell us more.
Well, the Tea Party folks threw in behind Joe Miller. They feel he is the lone true conservative in this race, that Lisa Murkowski is much more moderate, and Miller's their guy. So it's significant in a couple of different ways. One, these folks have money, and they can throw money behind this candidate and do their own campaign spots for him. Two, they're highly organized and can get people highly organized, and they're highly motivated. You're going to see a low turnout come August, yes, in the primary, and it's the person who can get his or her voters out there in droves, who can be best organized, who can get the message out. They have those phone trees working and direct mail and get folks out to the polls. Those are the folks who are usually the most effective. So I thought that this was going to be one of those sacrificial lamb candidates going up against the incumbent, Lisa Murkowski. Here's a person who I think by all polls I've seen is well-liked by Alaskans. She's a rising star in the leadership of the U.S. Senate on the Republican side. And she seems to do well for her state. Then there's this fellow, Joe Miller, an attorney out of Fairbanks. Again, I thought he'd be the sacrificial lamb.
And he's running as a constitutional conservative.
He certainly is. Yes, he is.
Libby, let's get you back in here. What does Washington make of the charge that Senator Lisa Murkowski is not conservative enough?
Well, they haven't been talking about this race as much as maybe we'd think, just because I think there are so many other high-profile primary races going on that involve Tea Party candidates, incumbents getting big challenges, and the Alaska primary is sort of way off in the distance of late August, looming quickly, but when, you know, it comes down to things down here, we've got primaries right and left. But this idea that Lisa Murkowski is not conservative enough, she's really having to step up now her conservative profile, right? She launched an ad this week in Alaska talking about her conservative values and what she's doing. And then this past week in the Senate, she gave a speech about how she wants to repeal health care, the health care bill that was passed and signed into law this year. So she's really harping on the more conservative aspects maybe of her agenda and what she's doing. And they're kind of cornering her into defending that and having that be her angle. The interesting thing, I think, about the David Miller race, of course, the Miller race is that how much money will go into Alaska and what will it be spent on? One of the stories I did see this week was CNN covered it as a David and Goliath type of fight. So even people down here see that Murkowski is the sort of the tall oak that would be taken down by someone like him. It'd be a long shot. She is stepping up her national profile, though. She was on CNN's State of the Union this past week, talking about climate change legislation, being the Republican person, talking about the BP spill and the debacle with Congressman and Joe Barton of Texas. So she is trying to step it up, I think, in a way that will raise her profile and make her less vulnerable, essentially.
Let's get Jill Burke in here. Jill Miller wants to abolish or at least turn into to privatize Social Security. What does AARP say about that?
Well, they nationally, just generally, they don't support the privatization of that. They believe that it will weaken Social Security and that it will diminish and harm the retirement security that millions of Americans have worked very, very hard for over the years. So it's not something that they're endorsing or that they see as favorable.
Steve?
Yeah, just a little flashback here. And I wonder if this is in the back of Lisa Murkowski's mind as she's going through this emergence of Joe Miller and the Tea Party. But if you go back to when Lisa Murkowski was a House member in the Alaska legislature, she was considered a very strong lawmaker. She worked both sides of the aisle. She had high marks, and people truly liked her and thought she was a very effective legislator. She almost lost her last election to the state house to Nancy Dahlstrom. And it's kind of a microcosm in some sorts that we're seeing today. And Nancy Dahlstrom portrayed herself as a much more conservative candidate and really attracted voters in that district. She was in the Government Hill District. I think the air base and
yes.
The Army base is in there. Portions of Eagle River all in that area as well. Nancy Dahlstrom was beating Lisa Murkowski after all the precincts were counted. I think it was a question and absentee ballots that put Lisa over the mark. So,
what's
now,
the message here? You want to cooperate with other people? I'll show you.
Well, I just think that this is, I don't know what the, yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is. You're not conservative enough for us. I think that was the message that was being sent back in that race, Michael, and that may be the situation here too. That, and I don't know if it applies here, but I'm just saying that the history is kind of following a very similar track right now, and I don't know if the outcome will be the same as it was all those years ago in that Government Hill House race, but it's something that I wonder if it's just nagging a little bit at Lisa Murkowski in the back of her mind. She said, I've been through this once before, and I really have to take strides to show that I am a conservative.
And Michael, if I could just jump in,
yeah.
the language that the Tea Party is using is pretty loaded. They're calling Murkowski a lame horse, and they're sending out press releases saying, you're next, you're the next one up we're going after. But really the question I get the most down here is, what's up between Lisa Murkowski and Sarah Palin? That's still in people's minds. Do they have some sort of a feud going on? Is Palin going to actively campaign against her? That, it's just the Sarah Palin thing all over again. That's what people are asking me.
Yeah, it's because Sarah Palin, for folks who maybe missed it, Sarah Palin endorsed Joe Miller.
Right.
So, yeah.
But Palin had also, I believe said that she wouldn't campaign directly against Murkowski.
Mm-hmm. And at one point, I think she gave her some money, too.
Right. Well, there was
yes.
a time she was going to hold a fundraiser for her. Whether she did that, I don't know. But I know that one time that she had talked about, Palin had talked about holding a fundraiser for Murkowski. Yes.
Let's get Jill back in here. Jill, you spent quite a bit of time this week attending a major conference that dealt with small business contracting and especially 8A contracting, which is very important to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the conference and what you learned.
This conference was a business development conference, so it was really networking. It was bringing together the top level officials from the U.S. agencies that are involved in this kind of decision making, from the Small Business Administration on down to the federal procurement, powerhouses, NASA, and other organizations, and really building relationships so that these small business owners and their employees could have direct access to these folks. Now, that having been said, it was also a conference to debrief people on some of the big issues that are facing the 8A world right now, which involve Alaska Native corporations and tribally owned entities because they enjoy privileges that the rest of the small business world doesn't get, namely sole source contracts of unlimited value. They're getting a lot of attention right now because they've been very, very successful and they've brought in a lot of money. And with that, with the flow of taxpayer money en masse comes increased scrutiny, and that scrutiny has yielded some examples of abuse, fraud, and waste. Now, I've heard from everybody at the SBA that's not limited to simply Alaska Native-owned mm-hmm. small businesses or tribally-owned small businesses, but it is something that for which they are seeking remedies. And there are other trends taking place in the small business world, like the government is trying to bring more of its services that it outsources back within the fold of government staffers. That's causing some belly aching for small businesses who are losing million-dollar and upwards contracts to the government because they're figuring out ways to do it without relying on outside agencies. So there's a lot going on. And of course, there is some proposed legislation as well as some ongoing inquiries from Congress members and some recent changes both to the way federal procurement officers do their work, meaning they have to justify those sole source awards in writing if they exceed $20 million. The small business doesn't like it because they say, look, this just causes a chilling effect and slows everything down. And then the Small Business Administration itself is tweaking its rules and regulations, which it hasn't done for more than a decade, to try to make things more transparent and kind of level the playing field for everybody.
And what I'm getting here is that there was a period where these proposed changes were generating a lot of anxiety, but we're beyond that now because they're starting to take place.
They are starting to take place. They haven't been fully implemented by the SBA yet. It's still in the proposed phase, but they're coming. And one of the staff members from the SBA told me, look, we don't think transparency is a big thing, and we're going to support increased transparency, including requiring Alaska Native-owned corporations to justify how they're using their profits to benefit their people, which is one of the intents under which the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created these entities. There's a lot of consternation from the Native community about doing that because, number one, how do you do it functionally if you're a small business and provide all this paperwork and make it work without a lot of headache to yourself? But secondly, no other private business is mandated by the federal government to demonstrate how it's benefiting a private set of individuals. And so they're kind of in this weird world that no one else exists within, where they're a private entity, but they're also congressionally mandated to perform a certain function. And so seeing how that hashes out will be interesting over
the
next
months. And it also is kind of a classic in that I think nobody really cared until it became obvious this was very profitable to some people.
That's correct. And there are certainly abuses. I heard that there are, you know, the SBA believes that abuses are not the norm, but they exist and they're working to try to make sure that those come to an end.
Okay, let's go back to Libby. Libby, the removal of General Stanley McChrystal this week in a very dramatic moment at the White House has Alaska's delegation talking. What are they saying about the removal of McChrystal? And Mark Begich is going to have a role in the hearings for his successor as a member of Armed Services, correct?
That's right. Well, really, the delegation sidestepped the situation with McChrystal, and they didn't criticize the president for having him step down. And Senator Murkowski says she supports the president's authority to make that decision. They really focused instead on the selection of General Petraeus as his replacement and had positive, really glowing remarks for him. Senator Begich said that he will push for a thorough but timely confirmation, and that nomination hearing begins Tuesday, so Begich will be part of that group of senators that he has to go before, again, to get this job, to be the commander in Afghanistan. So it'll be a very high-profile hearing. We will probably see the senator there asking questions of him that relate to the war.
Steve, I can't resist asking you this question. You and I have a lot of experience interviewing members of the military, yeah. In some cases very high-ranking ones. They're very charming, they're very bright, and they're very unrevealing.
Right.
How did Rolling Stone get General McChrystal to tell him exactly what he was thinking? Have a theory?
No.
I can answer this. I actually listened to an interview with this gentleman on NPR. He was really there for a short period, and then the Iceland volcano happened, and he found himself stranded with this contingent.
Yeah.
And so he had much more exposure to them for a much longer period of time.
This is called getting lucky?
This is getting lucky, absolutely. And he also happened to have a tape recorder at the time some of these remarks started flying. And so, you know,
You just wonder, though, I mean, when the words are coming out of the general's mouth, at what point did he say, obviously he didn't, this is not a good idea. This is not going to go over well in Washington, D.C., and it's not going to go over well with the boss.
Several other commentators made the observation, if he didn't expect this was going to be the outcome, what outcome did he expect?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Genius running war in Afghanistan? I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, and, you know, and when you can't sit there, you know, I was waiting for the... It's out of context. I was taken out of context. No, it doesn't sound like that at all, but that didn't happen. But
Let's get back to Alaskans and their problems. Steve, a number of Alaskans, and you guys have covered it very well at Channel 2, have gone to the Gulf of Mexico to both help the people who've been affected by the blowout, to learn from the blowout, and to try and get some perspective. What have they been telling you, and what have you seen?
We had a crew that was down last week for most of the week, Sunday through Thursday. Ted Land and a photographer, Mike Niederbrock, were down there. And we had been wanting to go down for quite some time, but frankly, we felt that there wasn't an Alaska angle just yet that we felt had solidified. And finally, when we heard that there were a number of people who were going down to help rescue birds and clean birds, and a number of other folks who were going to go down and help fishermen prepare for what lies before them in the future in terms of dealing with the aftermath of an oil spill and also how to deploy boom down there, we thought, okay, well, this is the time for us to go. So down we went. And I think the thing that struck us the most was the fact that the people in Louisiana who are affected by this really seem to appreciate the Alaskans being down there. They knew that these are folks who went through something very similar, whose livelihoods were put on hold, in some cases destroyed, who had to rise to this challenge. And it just seemed that it put them at ease. It was somebody to talk to and say, you know, what is going to happen to us? And a lot of Alaskans were able to supply those answers. And to us, it seemed like they really seemed to appreciate that they had somebody there who would talk straight to them. It wasn't
and
a bureaucrat.
Really no vested interest, and no, it was just trying to help.
Yeah.
Okay. Jill, you had a piece on the relationship, the ongoing relationship between BP and the state of Alaska, which is important and ongoing, whatever happens in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. Tell us, what did you find about how the state and BP are doing?
Well, we set out to answer a simple question, to find out from our elected officials whether they felt BP could be trusted in the state of Alaska. None of them would answer that directly, and that was very telling. All of them would answer saying things like, well...
Did they just try to change the subject?
No, they didn't change the subject, but they made it clear that they felt that the solution to that was putting in a structure by which it didn't really matter whether you could trust somebody or not. That's my take on what I heard. They didn't say that to me. So that there would be checks and balances, that problems would be identified, that companies would be forced to comply. I think the strongest response came from Senator Murkowski, who said that she had been greatly disappointed during the 2006 spill for which BP was responsible and some of the things that were learned at that time, and that she was going to remain very, very vigilant to ensure that BP was adhering to its word and would do so moving forward. But, you know, we do have this interesting relationship with oil companies and BP. They're the largest operator, nearly the largest operator. I think they brought in $3-some-odd billion in taxes and revenues in 2008 alone. I mean, that's a lot of money.
And a significant employer.
A significant employer. They have a long history within the state. They're the majority owner of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. You know, there's a lot of reasons that the state would have an interest in maintaining that relationship in a favorable way and not creating this climate where BP felt like, hey, maybe we should be looking somewhere else to do our business. So, and of course, BP is bringing online Liberty, which has the capacity, potentially, if the project gets the go-ahead, to increase pressure and volume in the pipeline, which is of importance to everybody because it
and which was on the front page of the New York Times with a certain amount of criticism.
Right. Yes. So I think that that there's a symbiotic relationship there. They want something from us; we have it to offer. We want something from them, and you have this engagement.
Okay, thank you. Libby, let's go back to you. Don Young is in the news today. He's had some things to say about the so-called Disclose Act. What is this act, and what is our Congressman for All Alaska saying about it?
Well, it just passed the House yesterday, and it would tighten up the disclosure requirements for corporate and union spending on political campaigns. And the bill's passage was a bit of a nail-biter, really. It only had a margin of 13 votes. Democrats mostly supported it. Only two Republicans did, and three dozen Democrats voted no. Don Young voted no, too, along with the Republicans. Corporations and nonprofits that spend money on political ads would have to reveal who they are under this bill and who their top donors are if they have contributors. Also, it's things like their CEO would have to appear in ads, you know, the way politicians do, to endorse them, to be upfront about who they are. There would also be stricter financial disclosure requirements, and it would limit campaign spending by companies owned overseas. And this all came in response to that Citizens United Supreme Court ruling back in January that overturned the spending limits for corporations and unions. And as you'll recall, that led to this big outcry that, you know, businesses would pour money into campaigns completely unfettered and essentially be able to buy or control the political agenda. Now, supporters say this will keep corporations and unions in check, but detractors like Mr. Young say it would actually hurt freedom of speech. And he said this week, you know what, if we really want to clean up campaigns, we want to clean up the election process, why don't we limit the campaign season? Maybe you just have 3 months of campaigning, or put a ceiling on the amount of money that people can spend on ads, period. He said that would be a way to really change the system. Now, there are some exemptions to this bill, including for the National Rifle Association. It doesn't apply to them. And Young says that's great, but it doesn't change his dislike of the bill. Because the NRA was allowed an exception, everyone else wanted one too, and now there are a handful. Groups on both sides of the political spectrum, from the National Right to Life Committee to the ACLU, aren't part of this. And Young says, well, what's the point if there are all these exceptions? So
it was all done in the name of fairness, right?
Absolutely. Although in the name of fairness, in order also to get it passed. And it had a hard row to hoe in the House, and it's going to have an even tougher time in the Senate.
Okay, thank you very much, Libby. We have less than a minute, Jill, but maybe in 30 seconds, if this is possible. You had a real nice story on the legacy of the Ted Stevens corruption trial and the overthrow of the trial by Judge Sullivan. What did you find? What do you think?
Well, his defense team is urging that there are permanent changes to the federal rules of evidence, which would require prosecutors to hand over any evidence that they might have uncovered throughout the course of their investigation that is favorable to the defense. The Stevens team says, look, unless Judge Sullivan had mandated this, we never would have found out these transgressions that ultimately led to his case being set aside. And it's important to eliminate any prosecutorial discretion in making decisions about what kind of evidence should be handed over. So they want to see long-term fixes. And that could be his legacy, they say, is fairer trials for everybody.
Okay, our trial is over. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.